In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. In 1877, the activist and reformer Annie Besant stood on trial for selling an obscene publication. This obscene publication was a pamphlet designed to educate the masses on birth control. And who better to defend her against these accusations of obscenity, concluded Annie in the dock, than herself. This sensational legal case, along with the defiant woman at the heart of it, is the subject of a new book by Michael Meyer. And I spoke to him to find out more about how it scandalised Victorian society. Thank you so much for joining me, Michael, to talk about your brilliantly titled book, A Dirty, Filthy Book. So that title comes from a quote, which is actually used to describe another book, which was first published in the 1830s, or we might describe it as a pamphlet. It was The Fruits of Philosophy by Charles Knowlton. So, bit of context, Knowlton's book went on to stir up a massive scandal in Victorian Britain that culminated in a sensational courtroom drama in 1877. And that is really at the heart of your book. So, The Fruits of Philosophy sounds quite innocuous, but what was in it that was so controversial?
First of all, it's really an honor to be here. Thanks for having me on. So this is a pamphlet that was written by an American doctor, Dr. Charles Knowlton. In 1832, he published it. He was a rural doctor, and he dealt primarily with what was early obstetrics. And he had, you know, female patients coming to him. And he thought he would write a sort of handbook to help women understand the natural cycles of conception, not necessarily how to avoid it in a modern way, but certainly described in this book, the rhythm method and times that you could get more easily pregnant or not. And he titled it Fruits of Philosophy because fruits would have been known to, you know, a sort of byword for conception. And philosophy in those days was a byword for science. So the Fruits of Philosophy is a sort of coded title for what was America's first published birth control pamphlet.
So as I mentioned earlier, this all kicked off in Victorian Britain when a woman called Annie Besant and her kind of partner in crime decided to publish and distribute this pamphlet. Before we go into that story, can you tell us a bit about the woman at the center of this, Annie Besant, and her life up until that point?
Annie is, she's a battering ram. She's a badass. She's unlike anybody I've read in Victorian history in terms of both her activism and how daring she was, and unfortunately, how forgotten she is. So Annie was born in 1847 in London. She's born within hearing of the Church of St. Mary Laveau, so she's a true Cockney. This is coincidentally the same year that the Bronte sisters published both Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights under male names, so the proto-feminist movement has not begun in Victorian society. Annie was three-quarters Irish. Her dad was part of a pretty well-known family, the Wood family. She was born Annie Wood, and they had descendants who had been the sheriff and the Lord Mayor of the City of London. Annie grew up in St. John's Wood. Today she would hear the cricket bats of Lords, if you can picture that neighborhood, or she'd hear people taking selfies at Abbey Road. And she had a really happy childhood as a girl. And then her dad did what some Victorians seemed to do, unfortunately, which was catch a cold. And that affliction killed him when she was 5 years old. Her mother, at a time when most Victorian women, you know, did not work outside of the home, suddenly had two children in her charge and decided to move to Harrow so she was able to put her son through school. Annie was sort of an afterthought, and she would sit in the backyard and read books. But she was lucky in that she got an education. There was a Victorian novelist named Captain Frederick Marryat, and after he had died, some of his money went to his sister Ellen, and Ellen, as a single woman, really bonded with Annie, took Annie in, and taught her elocution, clear writing. Miss Marryat also did not allow any novels to be read, but on Sundays you could read the Bible. And so Annie fell into that as well. And as a child, her big ambition in life was to become a martyr. She could have joined the church, but she thought she could be martyred for it. And she ended up, in many ways, as we'll talk about, being martyred for a very different cause.
Absolutely. So another key figure that comes into this story is Besant's collaborator and her partner in crime, really, Charles Bradlaugh. Can you introduce us to him?
Charles is sort of among that great line of London's cussed dissenters. He grew up near Bethnal Green. He was the son of a clerk. And Charles did not have formal schooling after age 14, instead clerked with his father. And he started getting, you know, very moody and dreamy, as teenage boys do, I think. And he fell into Emerson and his essay, Self-Reliance. That essay is all about society is a wave, and we're all individual particles that make up that wave. And we have our moment, and then the wave crests and falls apart, and those individuals all fade away, and nothing of their past transmits through time. And Charles is proof that Emerson was wrong about that, about this notion of self-reliance, that you do, in fact, stand upon the shoulders of giants, as Newton said, and you do build upon the thoughts and teachings of those who came before you. And the way he did that was, is he dissented with his father over Sunday school teachings. And his father said, you either apologize to the parson or, you know, you're out of my house. And so Charles decided to leave. And he moved in with Eliza Sharples. And Eliza Sharples was the widow of Richard Carlyle. Carlyle had published probably one of Britain's first birth control pamphlets. And so I don't think it's a coincidence that young Charles Bradlaugh ends up living in the home of the man who published Britain's first birth control pamphlet. But unlike Bradlaugh, they were not punished for it because it was a very different time in the reign of George IV as it was in the time of Victoria.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about why birth control was such a hot button issue by the time we get to the 1870s when this trial is. What were some of the oppositions to it as well?
That's a great question. You know, I think for as long as people have had intercourse, they've also wondered about how do I avoid getting pregnant? Because you find birth control, you know, in texts from ancient India and Egypt and China and Persia. Homer mentions condoms in the Iliad. People in Elizabethan era, you know, tried, hanging weasel testicles around their neck or rubbing, you know, otter or beaver, if you will, oils on their privates. And some physicians even prescribed bloodletting, where they said, like, you know, before you get into bed, man, because they thought that semen was the blood humor, just heated up. So some physicians would say, like, just, you know, open a vein until you're faint and then get into bed. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of spontaneity and there might not have been a lot of consciousness involved either. It really all changed during the Puritan reign. And it was seen as against church teachings and against God's way that sex is not for enjoyment and intimacy with your partner. Sex is for procreation only. That's what it's there for. And Jeremy Bentham in 1797 did write a quasi-birth control tract where he talked about the use of the sponge that women could use, the size of a walnut, he said. You could tie it with a string. But he sort of couched it in coded words that the reader would have to discern in between. He used a lot of Roman and Latin punning for it. And his reason for it was that it wasn't that sex could be enjoyable, but Bentham, as a utilitarian, was arguing that we could reduce the poor rates if we reduce the number of children. Then there was the Victorian era. And although Britain's population soared in the Victorian era, and the population of London certainly soared during the Victorian era, one out of every eight people of the British Islands lived in London at the height of the Victorian era. And it wasn't abnormal to have seven, eight, nine children at that time. But knowledge of birth control was passed, you know, orally, mostly in upper classes. Working class people didn't have that information. And of course, there were no female doctors. You know, we're talking in an era where if women did see a doctor, it was going to be a man, and it was probably going to be somebody like Dr. William Acton, who had, you know, he was a very influential doctor in the 1850s, 60s, and 70s that also said that sex is for procreation only, and that women have no female desire. It's impossible for a woman to enjoy the sexual act. And that was sort of the mentality at that time.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
And do we know much about what drew Besant and Bradlaugh particularly to publishing this pamphlet? What was their motivation in getting the birth control message across?
I think, you know, the rationale was probably carelessness, to be curt about it, because they were both quite conservative in their own ways. And Annie had married at age 18. She sort of accidentally got engaged to the Reverend Frank Besant. And she was pretty miserable in marriage at 18. And they went off and lived in a small vicarage up in Sibsey. And Annie didn't want to talk with other housewives about raising children. She wanted to be a writer. In her own way, she made her own career because she decided that she would write a biography of the lives of the black letter saints, the saints that aren't marked officially on the liturgical calendar. You know, this was a time when there were 400 publications weekly in London. This was the great era of Victorian paper. There were 26 newspapers in London. And she started sending short stories off under her own name, Annie Wood, rather than her married name. And Frank, her husband, got very upset with her. And she wanted to have her own life. She couldn't have her own income. You know, this was before the Married Women's Property Act of 1870. She had been married just before that. And so she could not sign contracts. She could not own her own property. She could not keep her own money even. And so her husband took her earnings from writing and said, you know, you're going to obey me. And one day she was alone in the vicarage and she stood in the chapel and something struck her and she just started speaking her thoughts out loud to the empty pews. And she felt a great power and she felt a real calling about, this is what I want to do with my life, is have my own voice. So she went to some pretty renowned clerics of the time, including Dr. Pusey in Oxford, and they all advised her to be faithful to her husband and obey the word of God. And Annie decided, I'm not going to kneel anymore. I don't want to do this. And she took the rather extraordinary step in 1874 as a young mom of two of deciding to leave the Reverend Frank Besant and move on her own to London. And her brother brokered a settlement, a separation agreement with the Reverend, where he would give her just enough of a wage to starve upon, which was £10 a year, and she could have custody of one of the children. So she took her little daughter, Mabel, and moved to London and ended up, you know, south of Crystal Palace in the neighborhood that's Norwood or Gypsy Hill, it's often called, rented a small cottage, and took on the equivalent of service work, you know, working at Tesco for the Victorian single mom, which was needlework and sewing. And then she slowly started realizing, I need to meet people and I want to go out more. And she made her way to Bethnal Green and met the dissenting Reverend Moncure Conway, who started giving her work writing pamphlets. And so she would sit in the British Library, probably not far from where Karl Marx was sitting in the British Library, and she would work on these pamphlets. And these pamphlets started really energizing her politically about the need to help poor people and the need to be of service, especially in London's East End. And one day she wandered into a bookstore at Holborn, and on the counter was the newspaper of the National Secular Society. It was called the National Reformer. And she bought the paper. And it was an organization that it turned out that Charles Bradlaugh had started, and the newspaper was his. And his mission was to remove the church and religious teachings from the state, the complete separation of church and state. And Moncure Conway and his wife said, oh, you should go and see this Charles Bradlaugh. He's an excellent speaker. And Annie, being conservative still at that time, thought, well, I don't know. He speaks at the Hall of Science near Old Street, and he sounds like he's definitely an atheist, and I don't think I should go. But something moved her again, and she decided to try it. And she went, and she was mesmerized by Bradlaugh's speaking. He was a great orator. And when he stepped off the stage, he saw her in the crowd and said, are you Mrs. Annie Besant? And there was this moment of recognition because people had told him this woman might be coming. And so the two, you know, fell, I think, quite head over heels for one another in the chaste, married Victorian way, because she was estranged from her husband. He was estranged from his wife. And he had two daughters, like Annie had two children. But he really listened to her. You know, she was 26. He was 40. He was living in Whitechapel, not far from St. Bartholomew's Hospital. He was living among the poor people that he was speaking to on a daily basis and advocating for. And he helped edit her works, her articles, and he was the one that encouraged her to give public speaking a try. And so in 1876, she took the stage by herself and she spoke, gave a beautiful speech that I talk about in the book on the political status of women. But because Annie followed Bradlaugh's lead and became a professed atheist, she didn't have that mainstream acceptance or coverage in early feminist newspapers. So this is a long-winded way of coming around to your question of, like, why a birth control pamphlet? Where did this come from? And where it came from was Bradlaugh had a publishing house. He had the printing press. Annie was an editor there and worked with him there. They had a bookseller of theirs or someone selling their newspaper in Bristol. And this man, James Cook, was arrested because under the counter, he was also selling Dr. Charles Knowlton's Fruits of Philosophy. And up until this point, from 1832 to late 1876, no one in Britain much cared about this birth control pamphlet. It was selling on average about 700 copies a year. Charles Bradlaugh didn't even know that they still had the plates. And Cook was arrested under the Obscene Publications Act of 1857. And Annie and Charles told Cook, like, you need to fight this. And initially he said he was going to fight it. And then he got very, very scared because he was threatened with prison time. And so he's entered in at the Old Bailey of pleading guilty to this alongside the murderers and thieves that were tried that day. And he got off with a 25-pound fine, which was exorbitant because the average laborer's wage was about a pound a week back then. You could buy a house in Notting Hill for like 75 pounds. And Annie was incensed. She felt like this isn't a fight we should back down from. And she said to the men who were with her at the National Secular Society, like, I want to print this pamphlet. I want to fight this fight. And they weren't so into it, to be honest. And they felt there was no way they could win. They were going to get jail time. And for Annie, it was going to mean a lot worse than that. It was probably going to mean she would lose custody of her daughter. But, you know, for her, this was her real cause or her moment that she had dreamed of since she was a little kid about, you know, becoming a martyr. And for her, this was the hill she was ready to fight on.
So, as you say, it was a huge risk, but they did it anyway. They published this pamphlet and circulated it. How did it come to the attention of the police? And what were they ultimately charged with?
It came to the attention of the police because Annie told them they were selling it. She wanted this to be a test case very much. She wanted the platform that an arrest and a trial would bring. So she put a notice in the National Reformer newspaper that on March 28th, on this day, I will be here. We'll be selling this. They had a print run. The first print run was 5,000 copies, and it sold out within 3 days. So by the time the police did show up, there was nothing left for them to seize because it had all been sold. And, you know, the first day the police didn't come and Annie was really incensed, and the second day they didn't come. And so finally she walked over to the police station. Their printing office was right near the Old Bailey, actually, off of Fleet Street. And she actually brought a copy to the police station and said, you know, we're selling this. And finally on the third morning, there were two detectives there waiting for her when she opened the shop. There was nothing to seize, but they arrested her anyway. And the charge was selling an obscene book akin to pornography. And they were booked and they were brought to prison at Guildhall. She and Charles were each put in separate cells. It was very cold. It was very dark. She was surprised that she had been searched, bodily searched by a matron. She thought that was excessive. And then they were brought upstairs to appear before a magistrate, purple robe, ermine collar, the whole deal, in a room full of oil paintings of men. And they were very fortunate in that the magistrate agreed that this should go to trial. It would go to a criminal trial. Because if he had just fined them at that moment and released them, it would have all been over for her. As a woman, she could not be released on her own recognizance. We were still under coverture laws then. And so Bradlaugh actually had to sign the bond for her to say that she will reappear. But Annie was thrilled because their arraignment made the newspapers. After they were released that night when they were going out to dinner, she was able to see the evening papers and have her name in them. But she was identified as Mrs. Annie Besant, and they didn't quote anything she had said. So she thought, I'm going to change this next time I appear in court.
Indeed. So she was clearly very aware of how to use the press to her advantage. And in order to do so, when the trial began, Annie decided to represent herself. Can you tell us a bit about that decision and how it went?
It's bonkers in retrospect. It was bonkers when I was reading it. This is 45 years before Helena Normanton becomes the first British woman to be accepted to the British bar. They had gone through a series of pretrial hearings that Bradlaugh very much wanted a special jury to hear this case. Special juries were abolished in 1949. But prior to that, rather than going to a jury of your peers, for special cases where expert opinion was needed, you could request or a judge could appoint a special jury. And the requirements in 1877, at least, were that you basically had to have Esquire at the end of your name. You were going to be a man. You were going to be taxed at the highest bracket of the property rate. And you were going to be a professional of some sort, either a barrister or an official or a retired colonel or something, you know, military. So they were fortunate as far as their cause because these 12 special jurors were selected, and the publisher of the Times of London ensured that his son was going to be on this jury. So they became the foreman of it, actually. And they would have a front row seat to the proceedings because I think they knew, too, that this was going to sell newspapers. Annie and Charles were also very lucky in that, in addition to a special jury being appointed for this case, they got the trial moved to not only a criminal court, but the highest court in all of Britain, which was overseen by the Lord Chief Justice himself, Alexander Cockburn. Cockburn was a coup for them because who better to argue in front of about the obscenity or non-obscenity of a book than the very judge whose opinion set the standard for what was obscene in Great Britain. And this was the Queen versus Hicklin. It became known as the Hicklin test. And it was about an anti-Catholic pamphlet that suggested there were lewd things going on in the confessional. And under Cockburn's ruling, it held that any lewd or lascivious thought or sentence in a book, I should say, rendered the entire work obscene. Now, this Hicklin test would be applied later to works by James Joyce and Oscar Wilde and George Bernard Shaw. Shaw, by the way, is an observer at this trial. He's 21 years old and rail thin and broke, but he made sure to elbow his way into the courtroom to watch all of this. And the venue could not have been better for Annie and Charles either, because this was no ordinary courtroom. The man who designed the Dulwich Picture Gallery, John Soane, designs the High Courts of Justice at that time, which was on the side of Westminster Hall. So picture that great hammer beam roof that what today is facing St. Margaret's Street and New Palace Yard were courtrooms, and they were beautiful. You know, there was a balcony area, big high windows letting in the sunlight, and you could hear the chimes of Big Ben and also Westminster Abbey coming into the courtroom. So Annie really got her stage. She got to go to the highest court in the land in front of the highest judge who had set the bar for obscenity. And you mentioned, you know, she chose to defend herself. This was very, very rare. And the judge ruled that no women could be in the courtroom, even as spectators. And so Annie was the only woman in this packed room going against two very esteemed Queen's counselors and a packed room full of men to an all-male jury.
So there were some really big issues at play here. Obviously, under debate, we had freedom of speech, we had the nature of obscenity, we had women's reproductive rights, we also had class, as you mentioned earlier, playing into all of this. What was the press response and what was the public's response when they heard about this sensational trial?
I think it shocked everyone that the press not only covered it, but covered it in a respectful way. You know, the first day of the Times, for example, wrote that it was the Queen v. Bradlaugh and another. But Annie's testimony that she opened her defense and gave an incredibly eloquent, long speech. We have the transcripts from the trial. She really did a crash course in common law, you know, over the 3 weeks before the preparation for the trial, and impressed the jury not only with her eloquence, but her knowledge and her reference to Shakespeare and Tristram Shandy and other books that have been called into question in the past. And so by the second day, you know, newspapers were running with Annie's name, including the Pall Mall Gazette, which was Queen Victoria's favored paper. The trial coincided with the anniversary of her coronation, and Annie's news was printed right under the notices of Victoria. And it ran widely throughout Great Britain through wire services and also reporters that were present in the room. It was spread to little tiny papers out in the Irish Isles and Northern Ireland, with today Northern Ireland, all the way up to remote Scotland, down through Wales and then Portsmouth and so forth. So it was a huge reaction to it. And what I loved reading, you know, it's so much fun to sit through and read old newspapers because you feel so smug, like, oh, look how funny they were then, or we know how that's going to turn out. But so much of London is recognizable in the stories. The tube stations are there and Harrods is there and Liberty and ads for Nestle chocolate. And it just feels really relatable. And at the end of almost every dispatch, the story would conclude when Mrs. Besant left the courtroom, the crowd cheered wildly because people would line up outside when she would go out to her hansom cab.
So she had popular support, but did the jury agree? What was the outcome of the trial?
It was shocking to everybody involved, not least of whom was Annie. She declared the jury to be stupid. That was her verdict on this. It really confused the Lord Chief Justice as well, because he had come on to their side throughout the trial. He felt that the prosecution, which included the Solicitor General, Harding Gifford, I should mention here, who became Lord Halsbury, who authored Halsbury's Laws of Britain, which is on now volume 103, I think. It is the book on British law. She had outmaneuvered them. And Alexander Cockburn, Lord Chief Justice Cockburn, very much sided with Annie, I think. And there's personal reasons for this, too. He had never been made a peer by Victoria. Victoria was suspicious of his character because he had an open relationship with a woman with whom he had two children out of wedlock. He didn't hide this, but he never got married. And Victoria felt that anybody who was going to be a lord had to be of the highest moral character. But, you know, in the end, when the jury pronounced their verdict, there was real confusion in the courtroom because they said, we believe this is actually a dirty, filthy book, as the prosecutor called it. It's an obscene publication. But we absolve the defendants of any malicious intent in publishing it. In other words, Annie had convinced them that she was doing it to help women with 14 children in London's East End to escape the predations of their husbands. So there was this real strange pause after they announced the verdict. And the Lord Chief Justice said, well, I'm really sorry to tell you, jury foreman and the jury, but we cannot split the verdict that way. So you brought them in guilty. But he did a very unusual thing in that he said, I'm not going to charge bail. I'm going to release you both on your own recognizance as you can leave. And we'll schedule sentencing for another time. And then he sort of behind the scenes advised Charles and Annie how they might, you couldn't appeal it, but you could say the case was brought in error or something like that. So there was a series of appeals that went on after this. But of course, while Annie might have won in the court of public opinion, she lost dearly in her personal life because her estranged husband, who felt cuckolded, you know, she's on the spot on the stage with Charles Bradlaugh, decides that this is his moment, that he could sue for full custody of both children. And Annie lost. And she's the penultimate. There was one person after her, person in British history, to lose custody of a child because of religious belief. Annie had Mabel, her daughter, taken away because she was a professed atheist and the publisher of a dirty book, because officially, because of that verdict, Annie was obscene. You know, it was an obscene book, and that tarred and feathered her. But it also really energized her and charged her up for the next stage of her career. And this is where I think the story gets even more interesting, is that she never backed down. She doubled down. And when the Lord Chief Justice said, you know, while we're going through the appeals, as it were, of your case, you need to stop selling Fruits of Philosophy. And by the way, in 3 months since their arrest to this point, this book had sold 133,000 copies. You know, then as now, the worst thing you can do when you want to suppress something is publicize it. So Annie said, oh yeah, we'll stop selling Fruits of Philosophy. And instead she went and wrote her own birth control book, and she updated everything from 1832. And she included expert opinion from women doctors who are now had started the Women's Hospital in London. And she included advertisements for douches and astringents and stuff like that. And, you know, she was like, I'm going to make an even better birth control book. I'll show you. And she published that widely. And that spread throughout the continent. And it was the subject of court cases throughout Europe. And it was court cases in Australia. But it sold wildly. And so she's really the progenitor of birth control publication and this public discussion of a woman's bodily autonomy.
So as you say, Annie paid a huge personal price for this court case, but it did not stop her career as an activist and a reformer. She went on to be involved in some huge issues of the day. I think we'd need, you know, 20 podcast episodes to cover them all. But could you give us a very brief idea of the types of causes she got involved in?
It's a great question. I want to pause here by saying too that she suffered while Charles Bradlaugh's reputation only soared. And he was heralded as like this, you're carrying the torch of John Stuart Mill. And he was elected as MP in Northampton, which was always his dream as a child. And he had run before these, you know, quixotic campaigns that had lost. But right after this happens, the trial happens, he's carried to victory. He's not allowed to take his seat for other reasons. That's a whole other long battle. But, you know, with Annie, she said, if I can't have custody of my own children, I'm going to work to protect others, and in particular London's. And so the highest office that a woman could run for in those days was for London School Board. And she won easily, even though her opponents handed out leaflets saying, this is an obscene woman and she published a dirty book. She won handily, and she campaign for things that we take for granted today, including free school lunches. She said, how can you educate an empty mind on an empty stomach? Along with the London School Board, she fell in with the Fabians, which are sort of proto-socialists. We're not quite to the Labour Party yet. And there she and George Bernard Shaw become quite close because Shaw was a Fabian. She decides she's going to start publishing a socialist newspaper. And she's actually the first person, the first publisher to publish Shaw. She serialized his first novel and then his second novel as well. And they become a bit of an item. You know, to sum up other things she got involved in, through the Fabians and through the movement for Irish home rule, she was very much involved in the first Bloody Sunday, which were strikes and marches around Trafalgar Square in 1887 that ended in violence, and she charged right into the fray. And then she had her publishing office off of Fleet Street. And when the Match Girls at Bryant and May in London's East End decided they've had enough of being treated the way they were and they were working with dangerous phosphorus, when they walked off the job, led by Sarah Chapman, the largest women's strike at that point in British history, a group of them marched down to Annie Besant's newspaper office and said, we need a voice for us. Annie said something at the time when she was looking back at this, that most of us say, like, someone ought to do something about that. Very few of us say, I should do something about that. And she said, there's centuries of moral evolution between those two phrases. And so she jumped right in with that and popularized and publicized and led marches around Bryant and May's Match Girl strikes. And then, you know, I think after she had been tilting at these very Victorian windmills of sex and class and labor and gender, she decided the next great thing to go after is imperialism. And so in 1890, she went to India and she ends up the last half of her life, all the way until her death in the 1930s, is in India advocating for home rule there. And she became the first woman elected the head of the Indian National Congress. And she became close with a young Mahatma Gandhi before he was Mahatma and he was just Mohandas. And though, you know, later they had a falling out as well. As in fairness, Annie had a falling out with almost everybody she worked with. She was quite headstrong and set in her ways. And the big change in her life, I'm sure listeners are like, aren't you going to say, if you know her name, what about theosophy? She became an adherent of the religion, as they called it, of theosophy, and became the president of the movement. And theosophy held that sex was a sacred act that was bringing forth a reincarnated soul. And so in the end, Annie renounced all of her birth control work and smashed the plates of her books, even though the torch she lit, you know, was soon picked up and carried on by the likes of, in Britain, Marie Stopes, and in America, Margaret Sanger and Emma Goldman.
So an extraordinary life as a whole. But how do you think that we should remember this moment in Annie's life in particular, the moment of this sensational trial?
I think she needs a statue. I really do. I think it's shocking to me that she isn't commemorated more in London. There's a blue plaque. You know, London, I think it's only 15% of London blue plaques are for women. Her plaque is on the house she lived in very unhappily after she left her husband in South London. And it just says social reformer on it, which is sort of like calling Victoria queen. You know, I think she's a little bit more than that, actually. I'd like to see that rewritten. I think we should remember Annie as someone who took a stand for a free press and the right to publish, that the government should not tell us what to read. You know, birth control remains the most cost-effective healthcare measure, and it's one that is still under threat. And there are American politicians, for example, that are invoking laws from that era, the Comstock Act and so forth from the 1870s, to prevent even birth control pills being mailed through the U.S. Postal Service. And so access to birth control, access to family planning remains under threat around the world. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to write this story was to remind us that this is not a new argument. This is not a new fight. And it really began in 1877 with a very brave single mother who stood up and said, this is right.
That was Michael Meyer speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorn. Michael's book on this subject is called A Dirty, Filthy Book: Sex, Scandal, and One Woman's Fight in the Victorian Trial of the Century. And it's published by W.H. Allen. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden.